We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' spirit, imagination, and rich history of storytelling and humour that is an inspiration for all Australians.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Bearer of Weird News. As always, I am your host and the suppository of all wisdom, Matt Harvey. We're back for another episode. We're dropping another fresh satirical slice into the juice of news. And being July, we've got a few celebrations to acknowledge alongside our own episode. Of course, first up, the French celebration, Bastille Day. Look, it's already passed, but we'd be remiss if we didn't take a moment to acknowledge the day, which marks the turning point of the French Revolution and symbolizes a growth of power amongst the common people who eventually led an uprising against the feudal system. That's really our vibe around here. I attended a local celebration and was happy to see a huge display of French culture on show. French pastries, art, music, dance, all on display. Made for a real festive feel. There was an inflatable bouncing castle that allowed young groups of children to recreate the famous storming of the Bastille. You know, a few of their friends go inside to be prisoners, and the children need to figure out how to storm the Bastille and rescue them. Children will be required to rotate the roles and be prisoner from time to time, sort of like being the fielder in cricket. Children who refuse to play prisoner will get to indulge in another fine French tradition as their friends drag them to the mock guillotine, where they will deal out some swift justice. We're out here offering free French haircuts, people. Get them while they're hot. For older kids, they can participate in a paintball scenario based on the recent street riots. They're told that they will not be allowed to graduate for another few years to really generate that genuine fury that we want from the French. There was no miming, though. Overall, 4 stars, I'd say. We're also celebrating Nelson Mandela Day, a day created to inspire people to embrace the values of democracy and contribute towards the ideals of ensuring a just and fair society. Nelson Mandela Day was launched in recognition of Nelson Mandela's birthday via unanimous decision of the UN General Assembly in 2009. To avoid doing anything culturally inappropriate, we here will be celebrating Nelson Mandela Day by partaking in a sub-celebration, of course, celebrating the Mandela Effect. Now, for those who aren't sure, it's a celebration of confident ignorance, as the Mandela Effect was first coined in 2009 by Fiona Broome after attending a conference and talking with other people about how they remembered the tragedy of former South African President Nelson Mandela's death in a South African prison in the 1980s, despite Nelson Mandela not dying in the 1980s, nor in 2009, when that conference happened. He actually passed away in 2013. Now, one of the most well-known examples of the Mandela Effect is, of course, the collective memory of a movie called Shazam that starred the actor and comedian Sinbad in the 1990s. In fact, no such movie exists, although there was a different children's movie called Kazam, starring Shaquille O'Neal. So, score one there for really inaccurate and weird racists? I don't know. Other recent Mandela effects to be celebrated include Boris Johnson actually staying home and not attending a Christmas party during COVID times. The Coalition being responsible economic managers. I'm sure some of you can remember that happening, but it never did. That onions are a tasty treat that belong in nearly every meal. Sorry, folks, that just has never been true. That Dan Brown had a series of interesting and well-written novels. I mean, I can even remember getting caught up in this particular collective delusion. And a mysterious persistence that there was a time back in the day when things weren't so shit and politicians weren't as corrupt. All of those things never really existed. Happy Nelson Mandela Effect Day. And finally, are you worried about multiple days of record-breaking high global temperatures? Well, don't be. Is it climate change? Maybe. All we know is that we need your help this July as Earth, the surprisingly popular blue marble in the solar system, is participating in Dry July. Yes, Dry July, the month where the production of life-giving water is restricted in an attempt to raise awareness of your over-reliance on water. Don't become a slave to water's refreshing touch. Be tough. Be an alpha. Join the Earth in not having any new liquids this July for Dry July. Now, before we get into the main episode, just quickly, I'm on my way to Darwin at the moment. By the time this episode comes out, I should already be there, I imagine. But just in case, I am doing my storytelling show, Wage Against the Machine, which is all about dodgy jobs that I used to work, the $20,000 robo debt that I got, and breaking a 100-year-old roller coaster will be at Dom's Bar and Lounge the 21st and 22nd of July. Then I'll be taking that same show to the Edinburgh Fringe from the 5th to the 27th of August in Cannon's Gate. That's part of the PBH Free Fringe and will be on at 8:15 every day. We'll be doing a couple other spots in the Fringe, so if you're around, feel free to come and check me out. Also, I'll be going to the Sydney Comedy Fringe. I'll be in the Factory Theatre, which I'm quite excited about. I've never performed in Sydney before, and there's three shows in Sydney, the 14th, the 16th, and the 17th at the Factory Theatre. Two shows are at 8:10, the last show is at 7:10. If you are looking for more ways to support the show, although I think the live shows are the best way to do it, join the Patreon. Join the Patreon, that is patreon.com/MattHarveyStuff, and pick yourself a little tier and you can get some of our bonus content. Get some of the bonus content, extra stories that you won't hear on the regular podcast. But until then, I will be the bearer of weird news. Let's start with the headlines. The National Anti-Corruption Committee has officially begun and, after only 4 days, received a staggering over 300 submissions from anonymous ministers about one Jenny Morrison's role in everything ever done. Ever. Twitter users have flocked to the newest Twitter clone, Facebook's Threads, stating, well, Mark Zuckerberg can't steal all our data again, right? Right? Upon seeing the popularity of the platform, Musk has threatened to sue Zuckerberg for running a better platform than he can. A whistleblower has revealed the Mormon Church has a massive investment portfolio estimated at $100 billion, which was referred to by the church officials as a rainy day account. Well, you know those Bible types. When it rains, it really rains. Like 40 days worth, according to the Bible. So you're going to need a pretty big rainy day account. Yeah, apparently they refer to it as the Noah portfolio, because nobody needs to know about it. America's Supreme Court has ruled companies can sue striking workers for sabotage and destruction, siding with a glacier Northwest, a concrete mixing company based in Seattle, that sued its union for property damage because they went on strike. Oh man, the Supreme Court is really fucking it up recently. Really looks like they're supreme in the same way that the clothing brand is supreme, in that they cost too much, are overrated, and represent a particular brand of idiot. Or maybe like the pizza, you know, it's just a bad mix. The decision sets a precedent that if a union strikes, it has to ensure the company won't lose any money, which, my capitalist friends, I don't know if you're aware of this, kind of misses the point of striking in the first place. Sounds to me like Glacier Northwest needs to take a little bit of their own product and harden the fuck up. Speaking of American stupidity, the White House offered measured support for the idea of studying how to block sunlight from hitting Earth's surface as a way to limit global warming, in a maneuver that, according to experts, could have unknown side effects stemming from altering the chemical makeup of the atmosphere. I don't know where they got that idea. It's not like history is replete with examples of the introduction of mass levels of, or loss of, one particular chemical en masse having devastating impacts on the environment and causing some sort of climate changing. If that had happened, we certainly would have massed as a species to reduce the impact before it was too late. Sounds like a pretty baseless pessimism to me, and the endless pursuit of inventing new shit has no place for naysayers. Nay, nay. You know, if everything goes well, we can kickstart the end times and enter our Mad Max era sooner rather than later. I'd rather be a blood bag on the hood of a car than do another interview with Rhonda from HR. A 39-year-old man has been charged in connection with a series of Lego thefts spanning months in Auckland that police described as an underground Legoland. Well, this must be an impressive haul. Let's check this out. Oh, that's it? That's your underground Legoland? 10 pieces of Lego? Look, I understand that with the outrageous cost of Lego, this haul probably comes for about $10,000. But come on, New Zealand. Get some real crime. I really think you've just let the standards for underground haul be lowered a little bit too much. Later, when the cameras were off, the police opened up the boxes and a fight broke out over who got to assemble the Batmobile. According to an activist group, Saudi Arabia has imprisoned a woman for 30 years for criticizing the Neom megacity project on Twitter. Now, if you don't know this, Neom is the signature project of Saudi Arabia's autocratic leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a 10,200 square mile linear city with no cars or streets. A ridiculous concept that is worthy of making fun of. So, let's do some jokes in solidarity. Neom's grand plan: spend billions to build a city that no one wants to live in. It looks like they're inspired by Melbourne's Docklands. They say Neom will be a futuristic utopia, and I agree. And of course, by utopia, I do mean the traditional meaning, a place that doesn't exist. Neom will serve as the modern-day pyramids, a tourist trap that has caused a lot of its enslaved builders to die in the process, but really brings in the tourist dollar. Neom is like the world's most expensive mirage. I'd call it pie in the sky, but it actually won't go that high. It's a bit more like pie in the billion-dollar hole in the desert. What's Neom's business plan? Spend billions of dollars on a city in the middle of nowhere and hope, you know their motto. Why not? After all, people go to Vegas, right? Neom should have just invested in a city on Mars. It'd be easier to convince people to live there than in their 10,000-kilometer air-conditioned mausoleum. Is Neom's CEO a magician? Because he appears to be trying to make billions of dollars disappear. Neom's CEO must have come from the Warner Brothers DCEU division. How else can you explain their enthusiasm for pouring money into a project that's likely to be a colossal failure? Instead of calling it Neom, they should just call it Jenga, as they're stacking unrealistic expectations and extravagant plans on top of each other while expecting the thing to never come crashing down. Neom's like a modern-day Atlantis, except that instead of sinking into the ocean, it will sink into the depths of debt and disillusion. Those are all our Neom jokes for today. I think we really nailed it. If I don't make it to Edinburgh, somebody come and find me. I'll be taken prisoner in Abu Dhabi, having been detained on the way there. On to the bigger news now. First up, it is education news. Education. They say you'll never get a good paying job without it, which is a good thing too, because at the current cost of help degree, you'll be paying it off for the next 20 years. Though that may all change in the near future, as University of Melbourne Vice Chancellor and man demonstrating the amount of avocado toast students will need to give up in order to make their payments on their help debts, Professor Duncan Maskell, has made quite a call. He has been publicly asking for the reintroduction of free education for all domestic students, saying it had become sadly fashionable to assume students would take out loans to pay university fees. In this case, sadly fashionable means deliberately exploitative or debilitatingly prohibitive. You get to choose the one that you think best suits you, depending on the degree that you have studied. As you can imagine, not everyone is on board with this idea. Critics were heard saying, "This is the exact thing we've been talking about all these years. You send one biochemist to uni to be vice chancellor, whatever that means, for a mere 5 years, and when he comes out, he's a Marxist, communist, socialist, anarchist, hippie trying to destroy the foundations of our society." Those, of course, being the relentless exploiting of the vulnerable and stupid in debt cycles so that they'll be forced to take on shitty jobs in order to pay off their debts. It's just capitalism, baby. You'd know all about it if you'd gotten help there and studied the history of philosophy. This year, it's only twice the price that it was last year, and that is a pretty good deal, because next year, it is going up exponentially. They say university-educated students are more likely to get higher-paying jobs, which makes sense to me. You could really leverage that big old educated brain of yours by leading the shitty workplace that you're forced to work at to pay off your help debt into a union, thus getting paid slightly more than minimum wage for the 9 hours a week that they say is all that they can give you. Maskell said, "The cost of education was a policy choice by governments, and other countries choose to make higher education largely free for their citizens. Currently, 24 countries offer free or heavily discounted education, not only for their own citizens, but for some, they even offer it to international students. So I genuinely don't understand why anybody would study in Australia for thousands of dollars a semester when they could be in Sweden or Greece for free, or at least for much, much less." Some of you may already know university education was free in Australia from 1974 to 1989. Some people even got paid semi-decently to study, which is very unlike now. In 2008, when I studied my first degree, a university student would end up on average with $20,303 in debt. It's a good thing these debts don't come with any interest rates, otherwise I'd really be in trouble. What's that? What do you mean the size of student debts is rapidly increasing? Well, I mean, they just go up with inflation indexing, right? So I'll just jump in the inflation calculator and I'll figure out what a $20,303 in 2022 dollars is. Let me. $2022, yeah. Well, that's not so bad. It comes to $28,169.72. I can handle that. So how is it that over 150,000 students now have over $50,000 in debt? Doesn't make any sense to me. Man, it must really suck to be them. Let me just look. I'm just going to jump into the ATO tax portal and have a look at my... I haven't looked for a while. Have a look at my actual help figure. Let me just jump in there. It shouldn't be too bad. What? What's that? What are you talking about? Ooh, that's me. That's me that they're talking about. Me and my $59,000 help debt albatross. I guess now it's just a race between me and death to see if the government ever gets this money. And poverty is my co-pilot. Well, with changes getting so high, the quality of the product surely must be improving, right? Why else would you charge more for it if it wasn't getting better? Oh, what's that? Group of Eight Institutions, which, if you're like me, you've never heard the phrase Group of Eight Institutions before, but actually comprises of Australia's most research-intensive universities. So if you've never heard that phrase before, you probably didn't go to one of those universities, because I'm sure they fucking drop that information all the time. So that includes University of Melbourne, Monash, Sydney, and University of New South Wales. Turns out those specific universities have some of the least satisfied students in the country. Explains why they don't want to charge anymore. Seems they're not providing a good product. Though the major universities have pushed back against new data that shows they have some of the nation's least satisfied students, as they point to their strong employment outcomes for graduates. Going on to say, "We are just setting them up for the realities of life. You think that they're going to be happy in the shitty jobs that they need to take to be able to afford the inordinate amount of debt that we've saddled them with? No! They'll be hating it. Then they will remember our uni fondly. You better believe it. Ask all of our alumnus if they are satisfied, and I bet the answer is quite different from the current students, my friend. Oh yes, I bet it is." And that does explain why they're so keen to get that free education going. You ever eaten a shitty meal? You had a bad time, right? Complained the whole time. Told everyone how bad it was. Maybe even wrote a review somewhere. You ever complained about a free meal? No, I didn't think so. Even a bad meal is improved by the sheer fact that it was free. Look, you won't talk about how bad it was. You'll just talk about how at least you didn't have to pay for it. And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good review. Like hard rubbish. You know, it's a little bit shonky, but it was free, and I'm happy with it. Let the freeness flow through you. Taste the freeness. Become the freeness. Really feels like a fresh influx of government money will turn people's feelings on their degrees right around, because at least they didn't have to pay for them. Moving on now to People Power News. The proletariat. If you're listening to this, statistically, that's you. Have you ever been screwed by a multinational conglomerate? Had your rent raised to a ridiculous amount? Are your basic needs becoming commodified to a level of being out of reach for you, the average earner? Then you are part of the proletariat. Like the ants in a bug's life, as a single entity we are weak, but together, ants strong. As evidenced by the multi-billion dollar owner of luxury jewelry company Cartier and AI rendition of poor man Stephen Fry, Johann Rupert, who, side note, has $7.5 billion, if we're being specific as to how multi a billionaire he is. He has revealed his greatest fear. And what is it? Bees? Sharks? Waking up to discover that the endless pursuit of money and value has left him hollow and void inside, lashing out on others to overcompensate for his own inability to find satisfaction? Heights? No, it's you, the proletariat, kind of. He says the prospect of robots replacing workers, creating structural unemployment, and the poor rising up to bring down the rich keeps him awake at night. And I say, good. Fucking good. Never forget, Johann. Never forget. When we come, if we find you early, we will keep you alive long enough to see a few of the others go before we destroy you too. Honestly, you shouldn't be able to sleep at night. You have denied the existence of white monopoly capital. And your account of the process of Africana economic upliftment and the saving habits of black South Africans is, to say the least, reprehensible. And I know that you are from white South Africa, and they did things differently there for a long time. As a country, you're the Michael Jordan of racism. Sure, you didn't invent it, but you fucking elevated the game. But we don't act like the savage white South African. We live in a civilized society, and we treat our fellow humans with dignity. Most of the time. We're better than you, even at our worst. He said he had been reading about changes in labor technology, as well as about recent Oxfam figures suggesting the top 1% of the global population now owns more wealth than the other 99%. How is society going to cope with structural unemployment and the envy, hatred, and social welfare, he asked. We are destroying the middle classes at this stage, and it will affect us. It's unfair. So that's what keeps me awake at night. He is so far from the problem, he doesn't even see the poverty, the working class. He's worried about the middle class, also known as the first line of defense. When things start to look bad, the 1% will send wave after wave of the middle class to defend them first. Cartier watches already caused the downfall of the former head of Australia Post, and she was far from middle class. The super rich and their advisors had a little meeting in London where they were advised that they may soon need to watch out for people with pitchforks and torches unless they do more to use their fortunes to help the millions struggling with the cost of living crisis. I feel both good and worry about this. Obviously, these guys need a wake-up call. Seems they don't have enough people telling them either no or that's horrid, you monster. This is a wake-up call, a reality check, and a warning all in one. But I worry that they will hear this and think, you know what? We should probably raise the prices of pitchforks and torches because they always learn the wrong lessons. They always learn the wrong lessons, even when their own people, in this case, the International Monetary Fund and OECD report showed that corporate profits contributed far more to inflation in Australia than wages. Which is, I assume, why the IMF doesn't use the word greedflation in their paper, but says that profits account for 45% of price rises since the start of 2022, compared with 40% from import costs and 25% from labour. After all, nobody wants to see themselves as the bad guy, right? Wah, would a bad guy have all this money? No, I think you'll find bad guys in films always famously poor. That's why they are trying to steal money. Whereas these guys, well, they earned their money, obviously. Claire Woodcraft, a fellow at the Centre for Strategic Philanthropy at the University of Cambridge, said wealthy people's philanthropic efforts had a bad reputation simply because the industry was poorly understood, poorly executed, and poorly regulated. Which is ridiculous. Since when do we go after industries that are poorly run, understood, and regulated? We generally give them government contracts and ask them to look after our barrier reef, or run, say, a job assistance centre or a refugee island prison. The kind of thing nobody will feel bad about if it goes wrong. And this sounds like a poorly run industry we should all be sceptical of. They should be lining up to give them government contracts. If nothing comes through, it's only the poor who won't get money. The rich will still get their tax write-off. Where is the conflict, right? Where's the issue? But with all this cost of living crisis about and record corporate profits haunting our grocery carts like the ghosts of paychecks wasted, are we actually looking down the barrel of an uprising? It certainly seems only the French are willing to stand up and fight for themselves, guillotining some monarchs in the revolution, and more recently, taking to the street to protest the increase in retirement age from 62 to 64. Apparently, it's only a working class revolution when it comes from the revolution region of France. Otherwise, we just need to call it sparkling outrage. I think it's time to rethink the budget. Because starving the poor has only ever motivated one thing, and the current leaders will not like it. They know that they're fucking up both the planet and the working class. Look, a small handful of capitalists are buying up land in New Zealand and building underground bunkers. And at a meeting of ultra-wealthy hedge fund billionaires, they considered using special combination locks on the food supply that only they knew, or maybe making guards wear disciplinary collars of some kind in return for their survival, so they'll keep them safe from the baying hordes outside their bunkers once money stops being useful. So then what is the fucking point of collecting all the money if you know that it's going to become useless? They even talked about maybe building robots to serve as guards and workers if that technology could be developed in time. I guess, fortunately, they're always going to need an army of us and our blood in order to stay young. So we will have room in the bunker as a human blood bank. 2 years ago, the New England Complex Systems Institute published a famous paper that sussed out the mathematical correlation between food prices and unrest. Every time food prices breached a certain threshold, riots broke out worldwide. And it seems things are getting pretty pricey. This feels like the wrong time to play games with the poor. If defense spending is justified as preventative, and that's usually how it is justified, well, it's time to rethink social security as preventative. Prevents illness, prevents unnecessary mental health spending, prevents theft, and of course, eventually prevents rioting. How's that for defense spending for you? You want to treat us like the enemy, eventually we're going to act like the enemy. And finally, Robodebt Report news. The Robodebt Report has landed, and it's the most anticipated outcome since the graduating class of 2001's enter scores. What? You weren't desperately waiting to see how you went through the year, even though you weren't really putting in a lot of work, but were really confident in your own natural ability? Okay, that was just me then? No problems. Look, we've talked a lot about Robodebt, and I can't sum it all up here. If you want a refresher, you can go back over a few of my episodes, or you can look at my YouTube video called Explaining Robodebt in Under 2 Minutes. And come and hear the rest of my Robodebt story in my live show, Wage Against the Machine, on its 2023 and likely inevitably 2024 tour. But Robodebt is the end game of the dole bludger politics and taking the path of least resistance when attempting to get back in black on the budget. Those mugs, by the way, are still sitting in boxes somewhere, guys. Honestly, the only dangers to the welfare system are public servants and policymakers, not the mythical dole bludgers and welfare cheats that they rally against. You know, we've never spent that kind of money on mugs. Here is the who's who of the Robodebt scandal. So Robodebt featured some high-profile names. We've got Scott Morrison, Maurice Payne, Stuart Robert, Christian Porter, Alan Tudge, Malcolm Turnbull, Catherine Campbell, Melissa Golightly, who is now deceased but still guilty, Annette Musolino, Serena Wilson, Jonathan Hudson, Mark Whitnell, Paul McBride, Emma Kate McGurick, Karen Harefield, Jason McNamara, and Craig Storen. These are the names of the politicians and public servants who lied, dissembled, and participated in the active cover-up of a multi-billion dollar fraud carried out against more than 400,000 disadvantaged Australians, motivated, according to Catherine Holmes, by venality, incompetence, and cowardice. Just quickly, there's some real beautiful turns of phrase in this report. Some real $10 words are on display, and I am here for it. It's a real vernacular spectacular. The report, a real 900-page turner, labeled the scheme as cruel and crude. Man, isn't alliteration fun as well as $10 words? The report says the scheme was devised without regard to the Social Security law, using an averaging process to estimate welfare recipients' income in a manner that was essentially unfair, treating many people as though they had received income at a time when they had not, with the hope of treating the poor like human piñatas, you know, something to hang up and smash whenever they need a cash infusion, or even just a simple distraction, drawing people's attention to dole bludgers, blindfolding them, and then letting them take a swing. People's champion and the frontrunner for both the 2024 Australian of the Year and the Gold Logie, I assume for creating the most compelling true crime documentary you'll ever see, Catherine Holmes, accused the architects of Robodebt of being an oblivious to, or worse, a callous disregard of the fact that many welfare recipients had neither the means nor the ability to negotiate an online system to provide evidence of their income dating back 5 years. Not to mention, you can't even get anyone on the phone if you try and ring later than 8:30 in the morning. But if every day is a higher day than the anticipated number of calls, Centrelink, then you need to start anticipating more calls and staff up appropriately. Okay? It's really simple. An unknown number of key figures has been referred for civil and criminal charges, although the names are in a sealed section of the report that has not been released publicly. It's the most hotly anticipated sealed section since the death of Clio magazine. But don't worry, the government has asked their friend's older sister if they can look inside their copy of the Robodebt sealed section, and they'll let you know what they read. If you haven't heard, is this your first episode? Where have you been? Come on, get on board. Robodebt had disastrous effects, including families struggling to make ends meet, receiving a debt notice at Christmas, young people being driven to despair by demands of payment, and, horribly, an account of a young man's suicide. Christmas? Come on! This is the modern reboot of A Christmas Carol that we've all been waiting for. Morrison is, of course, Ebenezer Scrooge, but his catchphrase is, "The best form of welfare is a job," which, frankly, is a phrase that you'd expect to hear from the mouth of Scrooge, both Ebenezer and McDuck. There were 57 recommendations in the report. 57! And that's a pretty good, very robust. So what do we have? We've got here that a body should be set up to monitor automatic decision-making processes, that Services Australia should establish a debt recovery management policy, that the government should review the structure of the social services portfolio and the status of Services Australia, and that changes to the Freedom of Information Act so that the description of a cabinet document can no longer justify it as remaining confidential. The 57 recommendations range from making it easier for advocacy groups to engage with Centrelink, including legal advice with new policy proposals, establishing a body to monitor and audit automated decision-making, developing a comprehensive debt recovery policy for Services Australia, reinstating a 6-year limit on debt recovery, and documenting important decisions and discussions for public service employees, and specifically suggesting that Section 34 of the Freedom of Information Act should be repealed. This is the section that makes it easy for government to avoid scrutiny by claiming a document is a cabinet document and cannot be released. This has blocked journalists from revealing more about Robodebt in their time. It also recommended that Services Australia should design policies with an emphasis on recipients and shouldn't reinforce feelings of stigma associated with government support, that consideration should be given to the vulnerabilities of recipients who could be affected by compliance programs, and that a new legal framework is needed for the use of automation in government services, with a clear path for review by those affected by related decisions. Ambitious to think that they will stop treating Centrelink recipients as easily accessible punching bags. It is so very easy to do, and we really don't like change in this country. Frustratingly, those who are criticised in the report will also not necessarily be subject to the civil and criminal referrals that are included in the sealed chapter. Those referrals themselves could be expected to take months to investigate, and the nature of them may not be known until the individuals who have been implicated are charged, should such prosecutions even occur. We don't know anything right now, but the report does note that on the evidence before the commission, elements of the tort of misfeasance in the public office appear to exist. So that could give us a good idea of the future of the monsters behind Robodebt. The report also noted that Where litigation is not available, the Commonwealth does have a scheme for compensation for detriment caused by defective administration, which would be a very euphemistic way of describing what happened in the Robinette scheme, where a person has suffered from a defective administration and there is no legal requirement to make a payment. It is not appropriate to say any more on that front. Pretty badass suggestion that those affected by the scheme may be able to make further claims against the government. But I'm not a lawyer, and if you wanted to follow through with something like that, maybe seek some advice that isn't just a stupid podcast. It's up to you, though. Bill Shorten made clear that while he understood that many people may be frustrated with the referrals remaining private, he did not wish anything to compromise possible prosecutions. And yes, we don't want another Brittany Higgins situation here. We can't have this one fucked up, guys. But man, is it ever so frustrating. We won't forget about you. As long as it takes, we will not forget. While the politics of stopping the rorts was a Morrison classic hit, side note, isn't it funny that Morrison gets caught up in these three-word slogans and obsesses over them, like making little trophies to reward himself? I'm pretty amazed that he didn't make a little trophy of himself stepping on the neck of a poor person with the slogan, "I stop these," on it. Secretary of the Department of Human Services from 2011 to 2017, and then the Department of Social Services until 2021, Catherine Campbell is someone really worth watching the future of. She was ultimately responsible for the Robinette's conduct and performance and needs to lose her current $900,000 a year job with AUKUS. Whoever put her in that position, oh, what the fuck were you thinking? Under Section 59 of the Public Service Act, Albanese could have retired Campbell without recourse. He had the power to do it, but that never happened. And I know what you're thinking, but Albo's the social services PM. He grew up in a public housing. He grew up with a mother on social services. Surely he will do something about it. Surely he will follow through. Nah, afraid not. Sorry. Look, it makes sense, really, when you think about the fact that not everybody is that connected with their past. Some people talk about their past a lot. Some people are really driven by their past. Some people just aren't that connected with their past, you know? Like, for example, take me. Right? I'll give myself an example. For a little while, lived in my mum's uterus. But I have since then spent zero of my adult life up until this very moment talking about it, trying to secure funding for it, or improving the lives of anyone else who lived there. So not all of us live on that same sort of reaching back to help those we left behind mindset. And there is, of course, our old friend Stuart, $37 million of public funding into a business that he runs, Robert. The report said that Stuart Robert, who argued that he was obliged to defend the scheme, despite his doubts about it, said, "It can be accepted that the principles of cabinet solidarity required Mr. Robert to publicly support cabinet decisions, whether he agreed with them or not. But Mr. Robert was not expounding any legal position. And he was going well beyond supporting government policy. He was making statements of fact as to the accuracy of debts, citing statistics which he knew could not be right. Nothing compels ministers to knowingly make false statements or statements which they have good reason to suspect are untrue in the course of publicly supporting any decision or program." Interesting. Very interesting. I think the standards have lowered a bit when it comes to what constitutes support. Stuart, real support isn't just saying yes to everything, right? It's telling people what's important for them to hear. To be fair, he's sort of overcompensating for his own misappropriation of funds by trying to charge the taxpayer $38,000 for his home internet, or as he prefers to call it, his sneaky good time money. In a statement, Alan Tudge said, "I strongly reject the Commission's comments of the way I used the media and that I abused my power in doing so. At no stage did I seek to engage in a media strategy that would discourage legitimate criticism of the scheme." Have we got a clip?
A spin doctor for the Morrison government tells an inquiry how they tried to shut down a public relations crisis sparked by the RoboDebt scandal.
And that involved, you know, placing stories with the, you know, the more friendly media, the right-wing media, about how the coalition was actually catching people who were cheating the welfare system.
In August 2016, Rochelle Miller started working as a media advisor for Human Services Minister Alan Tudge. As negative stories of the scheme surfaced over the following summer, she says she developed a media strategy of pushing a counter-narrative.
Feedback from the Prime Minister's office that actually this was playing quite well in, you know, marginal seats, Western Sydney, that type of thing.
The crisis management also included correcting the record when victims of the scheme spoke out, with the Minister's office releasing information about their cases to the media.
Did you notice any impact of the decision to release personal information into the media upon the nature of media stories from that point?
Yes.
And what was the impact you observed?
Well, there were less people speaking out in the media, which was the intention.
He has said that he's not received notification that he was one of those referred in the sealed section of the report, which is a damn shame. Few are as deserving as Tudge of an ass-kicking. I mean, a legal ass-kicking. The report is highly critical of the aforementioned then head of Human Services Department, Catherine Campbell. Remember her from before? Saying she stayed silent about the misleading effect of the income averaging proposal and the advice it needed legislative change, knowing that Social Services Minister Mr. Morrison wanted to pursue the proposal and the government could not achieve the savings which the scheme promised without income averaging. Holmes says that the sealed section in part is intended as a means of holding individuals to account in order to reinforce the importance of public service officers acting with integrity. But as to how effective any recommended change can be, I want to make 2 points, she continues. First, whether a public service can be developed with sufficient robustness to ensure that something like the RoboDebt scheme could not occur again will depend on the will of the government of the day, because culture is set from the top down. Second, politicians need to lead a change in social attitude to people receiving welfare payments. The evidence before the commission was that fraud in the welfare system was minuscule, but that it is not the impression one would get from what the ministers responsible for social security payments have said over the years. Anti-welfare rhetoric is easy populism used for campaign purposes. It is not recent, nor is it confined to one side of politics. Largely, those attitudes are set by politicians who need to abandon, for good, in every sense, the narrative of taxpayer versus welfare recipient. The Minister for Government Services, Bill Shorten, who pursued the RoboDebt issue in opposition, said the report showed the previous government and senior public servants gaslighted the nation and its citizens for 4.5 years. They betrayed the trust of the nation and its citizens for 4.5 years with an unlawful scheme which the federal court has called the worst chapter of public administration. The RoboDebt scheme was originally envisaged to save taxpayers $1.7 billion, but the class action resulted in a payment of $1.8 billion, which saw debt zeroed, erased, and saw almost half of the victims receive less than $100, some even getting a whopping 96 cents. Now that is value for trauma. Most people don't even make money from their trauma unless they go into the arts. And you, my son, have received 96 cents. All in all, the scheme cost the Commonwealth over $500 million, excluding the class action lawsuit payout, with estimated total of $941,391 million, and savings of $406,196 million. During the RoboDebt Royal Commission, taxpayers funded more than $2.5 million in legal costs for 8 coalition members. We're going to break this down. It was $795,053 for Porter, the social services minister from 2015 to 2017. $518,064 for Michael Keenan, the human services minister from December 2017 till May 2019. $477,528 for Scott Morrison, the social services minister in 2014 and 2015. $240,520 for Maurice Payne, the human social services minister from September 2013 to September 2015. $183,831 for Stuart Robert, the human services minister from September 2015 to February 2016, then the government services minister from 2019 to 2021. $112,696 for Dan Tehan, the former social services minister. $98,931 for Malcolm Turnbull, the former prime minister. And $5,626 for Anne Rustin, the Minister for Families and Social Services from 2019 to 2022. And these guys have the audacity to accuse Centrelink recipients of wasting taxpayer money. You know they've got money, right? They made sure of that. They've worked so hard to bump up their pay every year. A lot of them have filtered money into private businesses. They have the money. They can afford it. And here's a sentence you don't hear often. Why can't we be more like Germany? You know, the German government is considering whether it can make the former transport minister, Andreas Schuer, foot at least part of €250 million compensation that it has to pay a private company over a failed plan to introduce highway tolls. Well, that, I mean, that's for a private company, so that makes a lot of sense. We can't have private companies sad. Why don't somebody please think of the companies? Look, at least they are trying, at least they're kind of talking consequences. But the most egregious of them all, PwC, were engaged to produce a report which, on instruction from Catherine Campbell, you remember her from earlier, was not in fact provided, and she was responsible for having it killed, like it was a recipient of a Centrelink payment. The department paid $800,000 for an 8-slide PowerPoint. Fuck. That better be good font and sound effects combo for $100,000 a page. But wait, there's more. On top of all that, $11 million in taxpayers' money was spent on corporate debt collectors for chasing down welfare recipients for debts raised under the unlawful rubber debt scheme. The report showed three firms, Dun & Bradstreet, now known as Illion, Australian Receivables Limited, and Probe Operations, who are now facing calls to return the money from Greens Local Services spokesperson Janet Rice. She said private debt collectors had a financial incentive to recover as much money as they can, as quickly as they can, regardless of the human cost. In that way, they're much like ticket inspectors on trains. Doesn't matter how many elderly citizens, immigrants with poor English, or school children they have to bully, they gotta get that money to justify the exorbitant amount that they are being paid to stop the money being wasted. And it's all justified, the same way we collectively turn a blind eye to what was done in our name to asylum seekers. They are judged pre-guilty until they prove themselves innocent. And that's if that's even an option for them. And the ends always seem to justify the means. Welfare bashing pops its ugly face in to justify breaches of law, bad policy, deliberate, sustained, and systemic misleading by public servants, and failures of ministerial responsibility. But call a minister on their shit, and you better believe that you're getting a defamation case. Holmes said, "An enthusiasm for budget savings would seem an anathema to the underlying policy and rationale for social security spending, of supporting those in need. However, it appears that the social security portfolio was generally perceived as a reliable source for such savings." Some of those nice $10 words there, I mean, she would definitely win a spelling bee of some kind. I'd put money on her. suggesting that many citizens will, at different times in their lives, need income support. On a temporary basis, for some as they study or they look for work. Longer terms for others, for reasons such as age, disadvantage, or disability. And to provide that support willingly, adequately, and with respect. You don't have to read the sealed section of the report to know that a lot of people are going to face dire consequences as a result of their actions. But fuck, I would like to. I imagine that this is what it was like for Harry Potter fans before it all went to shit. I could see myself queuing up and dressing for a midnight drop of the Rubber sealed section, or I would be so into that. Holmes says it's remarkable how little interest there seems to have been in ensuring the scheme's legality, how rushed its implementation was, how little thought it was given, and how it would affect welfare recipients, and the lengths to which public servants were prepared to go to oblige ministers on the quest for savings. The Royal Commission's forensic detail of how Robodebt unfolded within two particular departments, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Social Services, is not just shocking, but the ultimate case study in bad public policy. And as I noted in my show, Wage Against the Machine.
We've got a real sense that they looked at the American healthcare system and thought, well, that's not a fucked policy. This is a fucked policy. Roll it out.
But Holmes paints a broader picture, not only of public service dysfunction, but specifically the failure of systems and institutions which are supposed to provide checks and balances for bad policy. Look, check this out. Turns out that, under current rule, departments aren't actually required to state that a policy proposal is actually illegal or contain legal advice that underlines the argument. Nor does data used by departments in supporting a budget recommendation actually have to be properly sourced. What the fuck? This is all summed up best in a single recommendation, so obvious and necessary, it'll be the first one ignored. That the department responsible for delivering government services, Services Australia, should design policies and processes with emphasis on the people they are meant to serve. It's a nice bit of optimism, but it does miss that obviousness of the message Centrelink is sending when they cut staff and deliberately include measures that mean less Centrelink staff will be able to speak to recipients per day. That there is a reason they changed the name from Human Services to Services Australia. Because the system no longer serves humans who need it. It serves Australia as a concept. Morrison is facing calls from across the political spectrum to retire from Parliament in the wake of the damning Robodebt Royal Commission report. Of course, Morrison denies the claims the report makes that he allowed Cabinet to be misled. Following the sudden removal of language from a February 2015 brief that warned legislative change was required. Yeah, as if we're going to listen to you, a guy who couldn't even remember that he campaigned on how shit electric cars were last election, over the 958,000 document submissions, 303 hours of hearings, and 10,000 exhibits tendered to the Royal Commission. Even the Nationals leader, David Littleproud, and Liberal MP Bridget Archer are among those who have suggested Morrison should resign. What?! Although some of his colleagues fear adverse findings may make it a little more likely he will dig in. You know, like a filthy tick, the harder you try to remove him, the more he digs in. Bill Shorten has heaped pressure on Morrison by declaring any self-respecting politician would be embarrassed and humiliated by the adverse findings of the Royal Commission. Problem, of course, is that Morrison has no self-awareness. Man thinks he was appointed by God. Does that sound like a man who steps down? Okay, the Pope, and only once. But generally speaking, people who think they have God in their corner, they go down reluctantly. Especially when your mates refuse to hold you accountable for your terrible behaviour. Isn't that right, Dutton? Hey? Dutton? What are you doing over there, Dutton? These guys are like the friendship group in an ad about speaking up against workplace bullying, but they never get to the bit where somebody actually does something. They always just stay in the first half of the ad where everyone shuts their mouth and lets it happen. Though, to be fair, if Dutton held somebody accountable for their terrible actions, then he might reasonably expect someone to try and hold him accountable for his terrible actions. And that's a well of allegations even Lassie stopped trying to help people out of. But what's that over the hill? It looks like there will be a punishment. A punishment? Who would be so bold? Who could risk their reputational damage of punishing a politician? Who is this glass house dweller willing to throw stones? Well, shit. That's a surprise. As a result of the adverse findings made against him by the Robidette Royal Commission, the Cronulla Sharks are considering removing Morrison's number one ticket holder status. Yes! Well, that makes a lot of sense. We all already know that rugby players are often terribly behaved pieces of shit, and this somewhat speaks volumes. When a leftist commie pinko comedian speaks out against you, nobody would actually care. But when a piece of shit starts to distance themselves from you, you know things are going poorly. When a group of pieces of shit distance themselves from you, woohoo, that does not go down well. Athletic figures are backing away, but Dutton is getting closer, leaning in as former number one enemy of the state and winner of the Voldemort lookalike actor-like competitions for the last decade running. He is enjoying being able to lean over to somebody else at the table and say, "Hey man, welcome to the club, friend." And you know it's bothering him because the spokesperson for Morrison and his office contacted Sharks management and said the story was inaccurate. Doesn't it really suck, Morrison, to have something that you like taken away? For some of us, it's the ability to pay our rent and eat food. For others, it's symbolic ticket holder status. But we all walk different paths in life. But as symbolic as this punishment is, and weirdly, as much as it will actually annoy him more than anything else that's going to happen to him, Morrison and other senior Liberal figures who gave evidence before the Robidette Royal Commission will actually still be able to charge taxpayers for their legal fees if they challenge any findings handed down against them by the report. What? Removing his number one ticket holder status won't stop him from being able to use taxpayer funds on top of the roughly $200,000 a year annual salary for being both an ex-MP and PM? I thought the best kind of welfare was a job, Scotty. What happened? These figures don't even include the costs of the final month and a half of the commission. So like most government spending, the $2.5 million bill we talked about earlier is going to go over budget. Former ministers are even eligible for the cost of responding to notices of potential adverse findings or referrals if any actions were received by them. I had to pay my bank money to get my bank statements printed in order to spend my time between three jobs I was hoping to try and prove that I was innocent of the debt that I'd received, and these guys are just racking up charges to the taxpayer like they're an airline or a restaurant on a public holiday. Morrison's expenses for the Robidette inquiry have been approved, which relate to the performance of Morrison's former ministerial duties as then Minister for Social Services, Treasurer and Prime Minister, which realistically means he shouldn't be able to charge anything as he went out of his way to not do his ministerial duties.
They know that, I don't hold a hose, mate, and I don't sit in the control room.
They're answers that only can come from Victoria, I'm afraid, because that's not my job.
We regulate aged care, but when there is a public health pandemic, then they are things that marriage from Victoria.
Because that's not my job.
Mm. That's not my job.
Not my job.
That's not my job.
Not my job.
To obfuscate his responsibilities and subvert the law. He said it was appropriate to give assistance, that costs would be limited to what his department determined to be reasonable. We still out here letting Morrison decide what is reasonable after all this? He has proven he is beyond capable of determining what is reasonable. Scott, Five Secret Ministries Morrison, who because of that incurred costs of 22,000 $424 for representation. A guy so out of touch that he thought he was appointed by God. And you know what? Maybe he was. Maybe he was appointed by God. Maybe God interfered specifically to show how corrupt and how incompetent the governmental system has become to help the poor, not directly, but by testing them. Because if we've learned nothing else from the Bible, God loves to test people. Isn't that right, Job? Dutton, however, has apologized to rubber dead victims, in as much as a snake can apologize to the mouse he is in the process of eating, and then went and criticized the glee of the Prime Minister, accusing him of politicizing the Royal Commission's report release. Yeah, don't politicize the report revealing the failure of policy. That sort of behavior reserved for refugees, or demonizing the poor, not celebrating their victories. Dutton, this isn't a mass shooting in America. We will talk about this. Not only that, we will talk about it with a political bent, as it was all political action. Dutton said he did not know whether any of his former ministerial colleagues had been referred for further investigation, and accused Anthony Albanese of trying to unseal the contents of the confidential chapter. Dutton said, "There's a presumption of innocence until guilt is proven." Going on to say, except of course, those we deem guilty without evidence, or by association without evidence, like refugees and welfare recipients. That's different, of course, but you already know that based on our previous policies, but we need to point it out. Nationals leader David Littleproud also apologized to victims and said this scheme was a shameful episode. Man, two apologies from one coalition? This feels like the beginning of any end times. Wasn't that one of the signs of the apocalypse? It's plagues of frogs, locusts, and coalition members apologizing. Littleproud said, "This is a shameful episode. The intent was right, but the execution was appalling. That's what this Royal Commission found." Did we read the same report? The intent was right. So we should be relentlessly pursuing and punishing the poor, just differently. A different relentless pursuit of the poor. Make sure people are doing it, not robots. Right, got it. Yep, let's fix that right up. Peter Dutton has conceded that mistakes were made by individuals involved, while warning against a trial by media on the findings of the Royal Commission. Oh no, not a trial by media. That'd be horrid and unjust. Imagine if someone's office planned to use sympathetic outlets such as, oh, I don't know, News Corp, to pick up a totally random example, to counter reporting on a scheme that questioned it and was sympathetic to its victims.
"We will find you, we will track you down, and you will have to repay those debts, and you may end up in prison."
Surely this wasn't deliberate, or as deliberate as it sounds, right? Alan Tudge's then media advisor, Rochelle Miller. Can we get a take on this?
"And that involved, you know, placing stories with the, you know, the more friendly media, the right-wing media, about how the coalition was actually catching people who were cheating the welfare system."
"Did you notice any impact of the decision to release personal information into the media upon the nature of media stories from that point?"
"Yes."
"And what was the impact you observed?"
"Well, there were less people speaking out in the media, which was the intention."
The strategy included finding case studies of legitimate deaths detected by the RoboDebt system and placing stories about convicted welfare fraudsters. Probably for trial by media, right? Otherwise, what would the point be? The minister's office requested information on cases that had appeared in the media, as well as cases supposedly demonstrating the success of the system. Tudge even personally involved himself in responding to the media.
"We will find you, we will track you down, and you will have to repay those debts, and you may end up in prison."
On top of the news counter-offensive, Catherine Campbell, remember her from earlier, was dodging legal advice and reports all over town. Not only did she know the scheme always contemplated the use of income averaging, which advice said was illegal, she also took steps to prevent external advice from being sought by Acting Secretary Barry Jackson while she was on leave. Can't have all her hard work undone while she was on leave. Campbell instructed DHS officers to cease the process of responding to Jackson's request for advice, motivated by a concern that the unlawfulness of the scheme might be exposed to the Ombudsman in the course of its investigation. Campbell ordered a $1 million report from consultants PwC not to be released. The report said the rational inference is that although the report was contracted for and all but finalized, Mrs. Campbell formed the view that its details as to the deficiencies of the scheme was damaging and that it would be better for the department's reputation and her own if it were not produced. So the government lied, stole money from vulnerable people, and then had the audacity to turn around and call them liars and thieves in the media. In terms of next steps, Commissioner Holmes reluctantly recommended against a compensation scheme because it would be simply unworkable, saying a better use of the money would be to raise the rate of income support payments from the Commonwealth. Which confirms everyone's suspicions that if people are properly compensated, they won't need to do desperate things to survive. At least, you know, not until they start making a lot of money, because that's like the bell curve. You do desperate things on the far end, on one far end, because you're desperate and you're poor, and then you sort of middle out into a nice normal behavior. And then when you get too rich, you start doing desperate things again, because you're desperately trying to hold on to as much of that money as possible. So you want people sitting nicely in that sort of middle range, enough money to be comfortable and have fun, but not so much money that they get greedy and, oh, I don't know, rort $37 million in government contracts through their own business. Right, Stuart Robert? Right? Look, now, even the Royal Commission is telling the government to raise the rate. How many more official bodies have to tell you to raise the rate before you will listen? It's not even stopping being punitive, if that's your concern. Because after RoboDebt, Centrelink hasn't even stopped being cruel to payment recipients. It's near impossible to get them on the phone, and nobody will talk to you in person or online via services. They keep directing you back to the phone. Not to mention, any system of means testing is built in such a deliberately obtuse way that it actually disincentivizes at least 20% of people who genuinely need the service out of pure frustration, which would actually be a higher percentage than that of the supposed cheats. According to Catherine Holmes, the evidence before the commission was that fraud in the welfare system was minuscule, so even if they just let everybody on Centrelink no hassles, we'd still have less actual fraud than there would be people being turned away by means testing, which comes to roughly 1.6%. That's the percentage of fraudsters. 1.6%. That is the number that we are worried about. Man, I get bigger surcharge percentages paying by FPOS. 1.6% of Centrelink spendings, that's roughly $35.6 billion. And even the AUKUS subs is projected at between $23 billion and $31 billion. And we don't get those until around 2040. At least this spending would help people in the now, not in the hypothetical future. The Stage 3 tax cuts will cost $20.4 billion in their first year, 2024 to 2025, rising every year to $42.9 billion in 2033-2034. We'd actually be saving money in the long run by scrapping those and just letting more people on Centrelink. I had the debt, right? I've talked about my debt before. My large debt was broken down into three smaller debts. Two very small ones, one very large one. Two are the result of my degree and Centrelink sending me a $1,000 scholarship to help with books. Something, as far as I know, that they no longer offer. Probably because they kept sending them erroneously and then demanding them back. Apparently, I wasn't supposed to get said scholarship in the final year of my course when studying my honours, as I didn't have a full caseload, at least according to them. And I guarantee you, my overnight sessions in the library would have begged to differ about the size of my study load. But they arrived at this conclusion via a points system. They do love a points system. Their point system saw me fall 3 points short of a full caseload, even though I was doing a full year's work and working on my thesis. But didn't matter, as according to the points, I had time to go and work more, and I could have paid for my own books in the spare time that I had while studying at the library. I guess I should have taken a job at the library. You know, people who defend Philip Lowe's decisions about raising the inflation rate and the need for more unemployment to help bring down inflation haven't had to deal with Centrelink's abrasive system. It's a special blend of avoidance and neglect. They haven't even learned not to use an algorithm on people, because while Robodebt was the perfect example of bureaucratic incompetence and algorithmic injustice, now the only thing that has changed is what the algorithm is aimed at. The new algorithm is designed to sniff out so-called secret relationships, because apparently a Centrelink recipient has no right to a relationship without that person being expected to pay their way in life. And people thought having a baby was the biggest financial commitment having sex with someone could bring. Now they might have to help raise a baby and be the support system for a Centrelink recipient. Thanks so much for hanging out and sticking all the way to the end. I apologize, I got a little angry towards the end there. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it spoke to you. And if you did, please pass it on to somebody who might enjoy it. Share it around on social media, all that sort of stuff. Rate, review. Remember our system. It's 1 star, it's 5 stars, or it's nothing. And do come out to the live shows. I really appreciate when people show up to the live shows. It is legitimately the best way to support the podcast. But if you can't do that, or if you... I'm not in your city, that's fine. Do sign up to the Patreon. That's patreon.com/Matt Harvey Stuff. Join up one of the tiers and get our bonus episodes. Until then, thank you so much for hanging around. I really enjoyed this one, and I'll see you. Look after yourselves. Goodbye.